Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Jenna Wortham.
I'm Wesley Morris. We're two culture writers at the New York Times.
I mostly write about how humans relate to technology.
And I mostly wonder about why they only talk about Girls Trip as being a black movie.
This is Still Processing. So welcome back to our show. Let's talk about what's hot this week.
I have now heard Wild Thoughts, DJ Khaled, Rihanna, Bryson Tiller. I hear it as my Song of the Summer parameters dictate at the store, at the beach, because I went to the beach over the weekend.
Yeah, you sent me a pin. How rude. You dropped a pin in your location. Gave me no time to meet you there. It's cool.
Despacito, we just found out, is going to spend its 11th week as the number one song in a row. 11 straight weeks. But I think Wild Thoughts is coming on strong for Song of the Summer. Let's do it.
Let's hear some of it. Wow, wow, wow. When I with you, all I get is wild thoughts. Wow, wow, wow. When I with you, all I get is wild thoughts. Like, that's what, when people say fine.
Mm-hmm. Yes, no, fine.
What else is on there?
Last week, I found myself sitting at my desk, to my great shock, watching O.J. Simpson's parole hearing. First of all, why were we allowed to watch it? I don't know. Why was it televised?
Great question. You
why
know
were
why.
Why were there cameras in this? I've never watched a parole hearing before, and I have had reasons to watch them, personal ones. Mm-hmm. But he's out. He's going to be out in October. And I've been thinking about what it's going to mean to have this man just out in the world again. I would like to think about what that means a little bit more. Also, I can't believe I'm going to be the person to bring up Beyonce first. But listen, this wax figurine scandal. I don't even know where to start.
First of all, that's how you know racism is real in America. Like, who thought that looked like Beyonce?
I mean, Madame Tussauds finally got around to giving Beyonce her wax statue. She looks nothing like Beyonce. She looks like Shakira, and it must be like somebody gave them the Beautiful Liar single and was like, do one of these two people, please, and they picked the wrong person.
They picked the wrong person. Well, the joke on Twitter is that it's Becky.
I said that when you sent me the picture. That's so funny. So, I don't know. This is crazy. She's just standing there in this sequined getup, and she just looks nothing like Beyonce. I'm like, who is this allegedly famous person? It's just strange. And so they decided to change the lighting and the environment around her to make her look slightly more like Beyonce, and she still looks like Shakira.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's just not Beyonce.
Anyway, what's going on with you?
Well, Mr. Morris, I took your advice and I went to the farmer's market this weekend.
Yay!
I got peaches, I got white corn, I got a ton of turmeric root, which I'm going to grate into some, you know, hot water for tea. Like, I'm so excited. You're right, everything's in season. Everything is so fresh and delicious. I ate my way through the whole thing. It was heavenly. I also had an herbal cigarette this weekend, which is not what it sounds like, but it's exactly what it sounds like, which is it was full of lots of things, including mugwort, which is an herb you can have tea with and also smoke to induce lucid
dreaming. Come again, J.K. Rowling?
My kitchen witchery is just on 100 right now. So I smoked a bunch of mugwort and I had really crazy, vibrant dreams. Very exciting development in my life. Also, Insecure came back, the HBO show created by Issa Rae and Larry Wilmore. It is so good. I didn't realize how much I missed while I was waiting for season 2 to come out, and realize how much I missed that show in my life. But I'm very here for more single adventures from Issa. I also love that we still get to see what's going on with her ex boo Lawrence and what his dating life is like, and whether or not they're going to get back together. This season 2 is already doing some interesting things with non-black POC storylines. You know, maybe they have a very diverse writer's room. I'm here for it.
I hope so.
You know, it could go lots of ways, but I have faith in this show, and I feel like they seem interested in trying to develop other types of POC storylines, and I'm here for it.
Excellent.
And I know you know this, but I saw Girls Trip and you came with me.
Yes, I was in that sidecar.
So Girls Trip is this new movie about four lifelong friends who go to New Orleans on a girls trip together. And it's Queen Latifah, Jada Pinkett Smith, Regina Hall, and Tiffany Haddish. And I found myself doing various calculations the whole time. Like, I'm 20% this character, 25% this character, 10% this character. But I'm so excited because I haven't done that since Sex and the City. I've tried to figure out which character on screen do I map myself onto. And so, it was so good.
So let's talk about Girls Trip. We should talk about the pleasure we had watching it. The other thing I want to talk about is just how much of a pleasure it is to watch a comedy starring black women who get to be funny. They control the jokes and none of the jokes are on them or at their expense, because what happens in other movies is something like that.
Absolutely. And I think we should also spend a little time talking about what it feels like to watch O.J. Simpson go back through this process of being released. And, you know, we're talking a lot about comedy and what it feels like to watch him be turned into the butt of a joke that is still being made after multiple decades of trying to wrangle with him in our larger American consciousness. And we're both uncomfortable with it. And I want to talk about why, because I think there's a feeling of almost protectiveness around him. Mm-hmm, and I think mm-hmm. I really want to get into that because it's super complicated.
Yeah.
And interesting.
Ugh.
And weird.
Let's get weird.
Let's do it. Oh, my favorite thing.
Last Thursday, I was minding my business, saw ESPN on at the gym. They did a pre-show for what was going to turn into O.J. Simpson's parole hearing. They had four people in the studio talking about what it was going to mean to whether he was going to get out, what O.J. Simpson's career was. There were clips of the Bronco chase from 1994.
Oh boy. Mm-hmm.
They went through the whole thing. It felt like there was a countdown clock going on, even if there wasn't. And in the bottom right-hand corner of the frame was the parole room. And at some point, they were just waiting for something to start happening in the parole room while these guys were talking about whatever else was going on mm-hmm. around O.J., like the culture of O.J. And if you're ESPN, I get it. You have a vested interest. You
exactly.
help produce
you need
this,
eyeballs,
this,
you know.
This masterpiece documentary, O.J. Made in America, that our pal Ezra Edelman made.
Mm-hmm. The Oscar-winning documentary by our pal Ezra Edelman.
So crazy to say it. But we've basically been living in the last year of relitigating both mm-hmm. the life and cultural significance of O.J. Simpson, the details of the trial themselves,
yeah.
what it means for these two people to have been killed, but for him also to have gone to jail, not for murder, but for robbery in Las Vegas. He mm-hmm. was trying to reclaim some memorabilia that he thought was rightfully his.
Mm-hmm.
And he got a sentence of 9 to 33 years.
Mm-hmm.
9 years is upon us. And so hence the parole hearing,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which he passed with flying colors. All four of the parole officers basically said, you've done your time. You're out.
What amazes me is that what we're litigating isn't even a question of guilt. It's just like, does this person deserve to be, how are we going to treat this person?
Mm-hmm.
That's the conversation I felt that I saw publicly, right? There's people who are angry, people who are outraged. And then you have the entirety of just the meme culture of the internet, which takes the news that OJ is going to be released on parole and makes party flyers. Some of them are hilarious. Some of them are in terrible taste. Like the one I sent you was co-hosted by R. Kelly, like all women underage women free. And it's like really disturbing. And then there were some funny ones. Like, I got a couple photos of a white Bronco, and it was, like, polished. The caption was, like, all ready to go. You know, I mean, we've moved so far away from what actually happened and why he mm-hmm. was on trial, and we're just looking at the cultural figure of OJ, and I think there's this defensiveness around him. Like, black people are very defensive of what it means to try to continue to prosecute OJ. And also, you kind of see, too, the way he's treated and the types of covers and the types of headlines that accompany pictures of him. And it's hard not to feel as a Black person, when you see another Black person being treated that way in the media, you just start to instinctively feel a little bit protective and defensive.
Right, yeah.
And it's so confusing to me as emotionally. I'm just like, I don't like all these feelings bubbling up at the same time. He is both a mascot and a minstrel figure.
But this is what we were dealing with 20 years ago. Part of the mascot, of course, is the thing that sort of made Black people rally around him in some ways, which is that he became this representative through the trial and through the defense's concoction of a story that was entirely predicated upon a racist police system.
Mm-hmm.
He became this symbol of any Black person who's ever been on trial for anything involving law enforcement and has ever gone through the justice system mm-hmm. and been treated unfairly.
Mm-hmm.
And as preposterous as it is for that person to have been O.J. Simpson, a pop culture figure who basically spent so much of his fame deflecting any association between himself and his Blackness.
Yeah.
He wanted to think of himself as someone whose achievements were completely separate from his race.
But even that, Black people were willing to forgive because everyone also understands that feeling to some degree, too. And it's just sort of like, well, you strayed from the flock. You'll come back. You'll find out you're Black. You'll come back. You know, and I think, you know, he was a version of, like, a Cosby. He was a stand-in for Black acceptability.
Yes.
And that was another reason why both white people and Black people flocked to him, because it was like he was doing some of that work of, you know, respectability and acceptability politics a little bit.
We've had OJ in our lives since the late 1960s.
Mm.
There are now generations and generations of people who have different associations within the divergent responses to O.J. Simpson.
Mm-hmm.
So there's our grandparents, there are our parents, there's us, then they're like our nieces and nephews' kids, right?
Who barely have any
context
for O.J. whatsoever.
And so there's a sense in which his having been on trial for murder is a complete entertainment, not fiction, but it's somehow not real to an entire generation of people.
And even the people that remember, people in their 30s, I mean, I remember the trial, but I don't remember it that clearly.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say, whatever you think of his guilt or not guilt, fine. But people didn't remember how gruesome. And like, there's just a sense of which he's just become, I mean, this is what you're saying, I'm just reiterating it, but
yeah.
He's become completely divorced from this crime.
Right.
And there's something really strange about watching this old man be the butt of so many jokes, largely made by white media establishments too. Like, I don't mm-hmm. know how to feel about it. It makes me feel so uncomfortable.
Part of the mockery of him and the sort of sensationalization of his potentially being released in October, the New York Post puts on his front page, "Bolt your doors, hide your wives!" exclamation point, with a picture of OJ doing the Joker smirk. Not to be outdone by itself, the Post has another headline that just says, "He's back and he's pulling the bars with his superhuman, ultra strong Negro strength." Pulling the bars of the cell open. They are playing on the racism of a Black man doing anything. It's what the police are able
animalistic.
To get away with
in these
police shootings.
Absolutely.
I just feared for my life.
Yeah.
I feared for my safety because this...
It's another iteration of that just coming out.
He's a Black man.
And so then you get in this position of...
Having to defend
O.J. Simpson. Or feeling like you want to. You feel that protectiveness.
Yes. I don't want to be in the position of having to claim this person.
Me either.
I don't want to be in the position of having to say, "Hey, New York Post, guess what? In your race to like write the best possible, funniest, scariest, most effective headline, also miss the fact that despite everything, you're not treating him like a murderer. You're treating him like a scary Black man."
Right.
Those are two separate things.
That's right. Well, not in their... I mean, that's
not in their
the
eyes,
problem.
But I feel like his being released, and part of what I can't get out of my brain is how weirdly suspicious the timing is. I don't even mean conspiratorially. Like, this is... his parole is up right now.
Mm-hmm.
But the universe in which this is happening during this administration, you know, he and Trump are the same age, basically.
Hmm.
And the idea that O.J. Simpson is just going to be out mowing his lawn somewhere in Florida.
I love conspiracy theory Wesley.
During this administration, it's almost like in a superhero, in a comic book or like an environmental disaster movie where they say, like, if the temperature gets above 99 degrees, the following catastrophes are going to happen, and these villains are going to get loose. Yeah.
If the bus and the drops jail below cell, 60 right, miles an hour.
The jail cell's going to go up.
Yeah, exactly.
And all of these crazies are going to get out of jail.
God. It's the Dark Knight.
It's like next week, Charles Manson is going to find his way out of prison, too.
Definitely. He's going to be photographed in, like, a Go-Gurt shop or something.
All roads in 20th century American race and politics and, like, American self-identity run through this man mm-hmm. and his life. He shouldn't be in a condo in Miami somewhere. He should be in a museum. He should just have a room somewhere in the Smith. Just
give, not the Blacksonian.
He should not
he's
be
not
in
allowed.
The National Museum.
I mean, he
of
is
African
in the yeah,
American
but he's
history
not
and culture.
Allowed to be in there. No.
He should just be in the other Smithsonian. He should just have a wing, because I feel like. We were just never supposed to have to deal with this again. This virus was supposed to remain contained.
If you could ask OJ anything, what would you want to ask him?
Jenna Wortham.
I'm serious. I mean, assuming he could even answer, because when he was on parole, the things he was saying, like at his hearing, the things he was saying did not make sense.
I guess I'd like to ask him how he understands his blackness now. What is it about his blackness that he didn't previously understand when he was a 31-year-old man versus what he's come to understand as an elderly person? Mm. As a
he's not
handsome,
really.
I mean, this is the thing. You can't really call him elderly. He still looks good.
This is the problem with OJ, though, is you look at that face. Does he look like your father? He looks like my father.
He looks like he's somebody I'd certainly go on a second date with. But that is a nauseating thing to say, and I don't
Wesley
believe
Morris
it.
Wesley Morris has been single too long, ladies and gentlemen. We've got proof of that.
I'd be very curious to know, like, how did people talk to him in prison? All those stories that came out during the parole hearing about his being a model prisoner and his being an excellent person to have in your life in prison. I mean, we all know how black prison is. I feel like I just wonder what his relationship is,
absolutely.
Given how much he didn't want to be considered black before, or he just didn't want to be associated in a way that reduced his achievements as an individual person, right? He was a walking exceptionalist in that way. And I just want to know, since basically the reason he didn't go to prison for murder involved his suddenly being made a black man by Johnny Cochran and the rest of his legal defense team, whether anything has changed for him in his self-understanding.
He still some way feels symbolic of American blackness and American black men. And it feels when you see a picture of him on the cover of a newspaper, you know, and he's being made to look like a minstrel figure. They've made his face bigger, and like he's always wearing some goofy grin. And there's that clutching in your stomach the same way you feel when you've heard someone's been, you know, brutalized, actually, again, by the police. So it feels like a public lynching in a lot of ways. And it's unfortunate, because it's like we can't ever remember, you know, we're not sympathizing other horrible people. We just sympathize with him. And it's so distressing.
I always think when this stuff comes up, I'm going to say something that is going to be very disgusting. And it is not an attempt to really empathize with this mindset, but they are very analogous. A lot of people sort of think about, like, what is finally going to break these Trump supporters' hold over their loyalty and devotion to Donald Trump?
I can't wait to see where this goes.
And I'm like, I sometimes wonder that too. But then I remember the same sort of completely screwed up, loyalty is the wrong word, but is it? The fealty that I feel toward O.J. Simpson. It's completely irrational. I mean, I could sit here and write it down for you. I could tell you exactly the history of America and how who got where and what and what he actually means to this country.
That's so fascinating.
And be completely aware of the fact that he probably killed two people.
Yeah, horribly.
Horribly and definitely, like, brutalized his wife.
Yeah.
I'm still not going to sit by the New York Post's headlines that play on the racism involved
and try to make him into a minstrel figure.
Right. I can't do that. And so I see these Trump supporters, and like, no matter how much you tell them collusion, Russia,
everything,
lies,
they don't care,
sexual harassment, nepotism, conflict of interests, incompetence, you name it.
They don't care.
They don't care.
Whoa.
Nothing is going to shake those people. And like, nothing is going to shake my not support of O.J. Simpson.
I get it. No, I get it.
But the thing that should be in the museum is the thing I'm never going to stop standing next to.
Which is?
The crucible of this country. The crucible of race in America and all that it means. And O.J. Simpson is the encapsulation of all of that.
Yeah.
Everything. It all goes through O.J.
There's been a lot of cultural denial that this is the country that we live in. And this is the moment that we're really forced to look at the ugliness of not just the past, the present. It's real. It's uncomfortable, but I'm grateful for that uncomfortableness because I don't want to live in a fantasy. I don't. I'm grown. I can handle it. I want to wake up. This isn't the end of it.
No.
It's really just the beginning.
We're going to be talking about O.J. again, unfortunately.
This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
My name is Thomas Gibbons-Neff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
So we're back. And on a lighter note, I really want to talk about Girls Trip, which we saw together.
You knew I was waiting for that screening invite.
You sent it to me. You said, I RSVP'd for us. And we had a great time. So Girls Trip, of course, being the new film out. Malcolm D. Lee is the director. Kenya Barris is one of the writers, the creator of Black-ish. Also, Tracy Oliver, who is a writer on Awkward Black Girl, apparently a young woman that he's mentoring, co-wrote and created the story with him as well. The film follows four lifelong besties, and they take a girls trip down to New Orleans where hijinks ensue. But we have to talk about this movie because...
Let's just say who the ladies are.
Please, drum roll. Drum roll, please.
Regina Hall plays Ryan. She's this best-selling author. Regina Hall, of course, being from the Scary Movie movies, among other things. Mm-hmm. She was in Think Like a Man. She was in Malcolm D. Lee's masterpiece, Best Man Holiday.
Yes.
I mean, I'm not kidding. That movie is great. So Queen Latifah plays her...
Sasha Franklin,
the disgraced gossip blogger who used to be a, quote, real journalist, but now has to... like
dig up celebrity
blog
dirt
for, blog for money.
Yeah.
Jada Pinkett Smith plays, is she a doctor or a nurse? She's in Scrubs at some point.
I think she's supposed to be like a really high powered like surgeon.
But is like neurotic and committed to her family to a degree to which makes her uptight. And lastly, Tiffany Haddish plays Dina.
Yes.
The id of the whole group.
Yeah. The wild child.
The wild.
Like I totally want to be a Dina, but I know I'm a Ryan. And I'm definitely not a Lisa.
I saw a little Dina from you over the weekend.
Don't look at my DMs. Don't look at my Instagrams. Don't look at my videos. Okay?
So these guys used to be a crew.
Yes, and they went to FAMU. Can we just talk about for a second how unbelievably black this movie is?
Yes.
So
by all means.
the movie starts off and you understand that these are like best friends. They've like, life has, you know, they've drifted apart a little bit. And so they haven't hung out as much as they used to. It's been 2 years. Ryan's like, I want to get my girls together. Let's chill. But they don't just get together. They go to Essence Festival. They're right. watching Maxwell. There's a scene with Diddy, who's playing himself, Diddy, in the movie. Yeah. They live in Atlanta, or they're, at some point someone's in Atlanta. They went to FAMU, fam. Like, it's just, there's something so undeniably FUBU about this movie that is, that makes me want to, like, I actually need to go see it again and actually pay to see it because I want to support it that much. I don't know that I've ever seen a movie that unapologetically Black in years. Mm-hmm. Like, since Soul Food years. You know what I mean? Like, because even Blackish, the ABC TV show that Kenya works on, it's still kind of tailored for any audience. Like,
it
anybody
knows
can watch
white
it.
People are watching.
Yeah, it knows white people are watching. This movie, I mean, there's an entire plot line around an Instagram hoe. Like, it is just doing the most. There's celebrity cameos in this movie that you won't know who they are unless you know about Black entertainment. And just, like, Ayelana shows up. Like, you don't know who that is unless you watch OWN.
Elanya Van Zandt, although she did have a TV show in the mid-90s.
A lot of people did. A lot of people had TV. They were giving them out like free Groupons. But
so,
I'm just saying.
Before we like try to situate this in the larger context of this type of movie and like from whence it came, I have to tell you, you know how you always air my business about going to the movies with me and like, well, here's what Wesley's like when we go to the movies together.
Oh, the plot thickens.
I have to say, I was just sitting there watching a movie minding my business. With my buddy Jenna. And all of a sudden, something is going on, and I get hit in the head. Jenna is blocking my view to the screen.
I was out of my seat.
The entire theater, every Black woman in the theater has lost their minds. And I don't know what's happening, honestly, because I always
Listeners,
feel like I'm plugged into this
let
stuff.
Let me tell you what has happened. And let me tell you something about yourself
scared.
Because you didn't know what was going on.
I didn't know.
So at this point in the movie, we find out who the love interest is going to be, who the man meet of the movie is going to be,
right.
so to speak. So the women are already in New Orleans. They've landed. They're like throwing Mardi Gras beads off a balcony. And they're like whooping it up. They're drinking hurricanes or tossing Mardi Gras beads off the thing. And then the camera zooms in and you see this beautiful man walking down the street. And it is none other than Ralph Angel Bordelone, who is on Queen Sugar, who is fine as hell. And I don't even date men. And he, let me tell you something. We were all the women started screaming. I was like pumping my fist in the
air.
You
hit me in the head.
And you were just sitting there. And I had to reach over you and hold the hand of the woman on the other side of you, who was also screaming because we were like, yes. But he is so fine that even like every single time there's a Queen Sugar premiere, Oprah is glued to his side. She always has her hand in his shirt. He's like 23 years old, by the way, but he is...
He's a handsome man. It's true.
So that's why we all went ham.
I mean, I've experienced similar things, but I did not think... Usually I know what they are. This was like, I don't know. What is it? Everybody's going crazy
well,
right
Kofi,
now.
Kofi, if you listen to this show and you want to be on the show, hit us up. We would love to host you. Ralph Angel. There's something so brilliant about... using that actor who has been in lots of things and he's very talented, but also has been like a breakout star on Queen Sugar, which is, of course, a very, very Black show as well. And the person he plays in that show is just like such a heartthrob and like a tender little melty moon of just like a human who's just trying to do the right thing, make his way in the world. But just casting him in this movie is speaking to that audience. It's very much in conversation with the like hordes of Black women who are going to see this movie,
right.
which is the other thing about it. There is something that Kenya and Malcolm are doing that to me feels extraordinarily deliberate in the making of this movie. It is laden with Black signifiers. Also even bringing in Tracy Oliver, who, I mean, I looked up her IMDb page. She's basically only really worked on Awkward Black Girl being the web series that Issa Rae's show Insecure is loosely based on, or the show that got her in the door to make a show with HBO. So they're doing this very deliberate thing, and Ava does it too, where they're bringing in other aspiring Black filmmakers and writers and directors and giving them a place to work and giving them... So I don't know. For me, watching that movie, I was very... I felt very much like I did when I listened to 444 and listened to Jay-Z talk about a legacy and Blue asking Daddy what's a will. Like, they're building blocks to create a type of Black entertainment that we don't get to see, which is to me very awe-inspiring. It was very exciting.
Yes. So the pleasure of this movie for me comes entirely from how different it is from other movies like it. First of all, it's rare to get four Black women in a movie. It's also rare for those four black women to be together for the purpose of comedy. Typically what happens is you get four black women and somebody's going to be in tears and the movie's going to be a drama.
Someone gets cancer.
Something, yes.
Somebody gets pregnant.
Somebody cheats on Whitney or Angela. I really appreciate the commitment to keeping the comedy on the front burner
absolutely,
at all times.
Absolutely. And the movie's hilarious.
Yes. And a lot of that energy comes from Tiffany Haddish, who was doing something totally new for the movies, but just like the thing you experience in real life if you have certain girlfriends.
First of all, she seems like she's very authentically playing herself. Like she's not changing her accent or her diction, but she's essentially just extraordinarily black. And if you, I mean, I'm someone, I have, you know, I talk differently or whatever, but I have so many women in my life who speak in this way. And the fact that she gets to be like super country, her voice is very twangy. She's raunchy, but not in a way that it doesn't feel like put on or written into, like she's supposed to be this hypersexualized sort of like black hottie. Like she just seems to be really playing the role of a woman who's extraordinarily like outgoing and an extrovert and is the troublemaker.
She's the friend
stir.
You would never want to go on this trip without.
Exactly. She right. is the glue that holds everything together. And it's just, I found that to be, I mean, I've been thinking about this since I've seen her, but I was amazed at how little I get to see that version of a black person and a black woman specifically act on screen. I mean,
No, you're right. Projecting? Typically how that person works is Tiffany Haddish is Anna Faris's best friend in something.
No, right, right.
So that character is the like, it is the way we think of stereotypical black girl in movie mm-hmm. that doesn't star other black people.
Right.
She
right.
is loud. She is sexualized. Her body parts move to express thoughts and feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the way we have come to understand black femininity. And that is also what we've been conditioned, not only as moviegoers,
right.
but as people who live in the world, to fear. Right? Mm-hmm.
We're either afraid of it or we laugh at it.
Right.
And in this movie, it doesn't function on either of those things.
Right. I mean, we're supposed to laugh at it, but you understand that you're laughing at a person.
Not a black character right. or a black stereotype.
Exactly. You're laughing at a woman. You're laughing at
a comedian.
At a comedian, basically.
A physical.
Exactly. Right.
You're laughing at an extraordinarily gifted and physical, someone who's comfortable with the physicality of comedy. And it works because it's a black landscape. It's not her being propped up by other white comedians. The humor is working on a vector of blackness, but it isn't the spectacle of blackness.
Right.
It's her familiarity and her comfort with being so black. Yeah. Like there's a scene, like my favorite scene in the movie is when they're like, Dina, look at us, calm down. She's like, I'm so calm, but she's just taking off her earrings, which is a joke about like a black woman takes off her earrings
before I
fight, put my hair up and take my earrings off.
Right.
And just the way she's like, I'm good. But she's like continuously taking off her earrings. It's like the funniest. It's just so funny.
And then
like,
she goes in.
And then she goes in and she, you know.
We'll play an earlier clip. This is when they're on their way to New Orleans. Tiffany Haddish's character, Dina, runs into Jada Pinkett Smith's character in the waiting lounge before they get on the flight. And she shares with Jada Pinkett Smith's character, who is very uptight, very churchy. She's got a little special gift tucked away somewhere.
You know, I got some bomb-ass kush if you want to take a hit of it before you get on the plane.
Where did you hide? You know what? Never mind. I'm not even going to ask.
Fine, I ain't going to tell you. Okay, I'm going to tell you. Where the sun don't shine. You know, a lot of people think that means the vagina. But actually, it's the butthole. I got drugs in my booty.
You know what? That can cause a lot of infection.
Girl, you can't get no infection in your booty hole. It's a booty hole.
She's beautiful, too.
Yes. Yeah, she looks like my cousin Wafer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think it's really amazing that these women's sexuality is allowed to be taken seriously, but also gets to have comedy built around it.
Oh, 100%.
And this feels different to me than what was happening at the end of that golden era for all kinds of black movies that we were talking about before in the 90s, where at the end of it, what you were getting were these things like raunchy comedies like Woo, which starred Jada Pinkett Smith and Jamie Foxx, and were all about just like how nasty and degrading black women and sex were.
Mm.
This is a movie that is unembarrassed about experiences that all women have slash want to have. Mm-hmm. But is like these are Black women having them. And so in some ways they are Black, but they aren't exclusively Black. And they also are funny in a way that isn't degrading to Black women the way Black women are typically used mm-hmm. by movies
yeah.
that aren't by, well, they can be by Black filmmakers and have been.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a movie that finds a lot of ways to celebrate how fun it is to figure out ways to please people sexually.
Right, right.
And the idea that this is happening around Black sexuality is so interesting to me. And it's exciting and it's fun. And it's nice to leave a movie that has these things on its mind that doesn't also make me want to cry.
So what's happening now? Like, why are these movies all coming back?
Well, I mean, I think Will Packer is the producer of this movie. Packer has followed a very successful production model that someone like Jason Blum of Blumhouse Productions. Blumhouse, of course, does the horror movies. They make It Out, helped make Whiplash.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That guy's ingenious. And some of the thing that makes him ingenious is also what makes Will Packer successful.
Let's speculate on the financing a little bit of this movie. Because there's something else happening, right? There's never been a dearth of Black talent. There's never been a dearth of Black filmmakers and writers and people who can make all this stuff.
No,
what's been missing has been the money.
Mm-hmm.
This whole movie is full of ads for Ciroc, Mercedes-Benz. What was the other one? I wrote it down. There was like three main labels that kept popping up. So
the whole thing is also set
at Essence Fest. Yeah, so yeah. There's just so much branding in the movie that normally, I mean, most movies don't have that such blatant branding unless it's being they're sponsoring the movie in some way. So right. I thought that was kind of interesting too. Mm-hmm, that there's clearly a new model that's being worked out. And frankly, like in this instance, I'm willing to put up with it because I feel like if this is how these movies get made, then I'm fine with it.
I think that the models are really important, but I also think that the way we classify, I mean, I know we're talking about this movie as a Black movie, but it's different. It's one thing for us to talk about this movie as a Black movie, and it's something else for the media reception and conversation around this movie to be talked about as a Black movie. For instance.
And is that what's happening?
That seems to be, I mean, that's a version of what always happens with these films. So the number one movie at the box office last weekend was Dunkirk. Dunkirk made about less than $2,000 per screen than Girls Trip. And Girls Trip's numbers are pretty high. The thing about the numbers that are interesting is I don't know who saw Dunkirk. I don't know what the demographics were on that movie. But if you dig around a little bit and you read, you know, for instance, if you go to Box Office Mojo and you read the story about, you know, who did well over the weekend, when you get to the excitement over how well Girls Trip did, there is not surprise, which is a relief, because they always act surprised when
Hidden Figures too,
when Rydell,
wow, right, people exactly. went to see Hidden Figures.
We can't believe all
Jesus
this money.
Effing Christ.
Hidden Figures is
yeah,
making.
Yeah, it was so obnoxious.
And so, but I don't know who saw Dunkirk. I don't know
Not
if
me.
Asians saw it. I don't know if Latinos went. I don't know how white the audience was. But you better believe when a Black movie opens,
yeah,
you know the phone number and the street address of everybody who went.
Ugh.
What's reported by Box Office Mojo is the following. Girls Trip played to an audience that was 79% female versus 21% male, of which 50% of the overall audience was under the age of 30. Additionally, 59% of the audience was African-American, 19% Caucasian, 17% Hispanic, and 3% Asian. I would just say that I don't know who saw Spider-Man over the weekend. I don't know who saw War for the Planet of the Apes. I just find it interesting that when you get these demographics reports, they like Dunkirk is just a movie that everybody saw. And Girls Trip is a movie that, like, these specific breakdowns of people saw.
Yeah.
And I think that's the way the studios think of these movies. Dunkirk is just a movie.
It's just a movie.
Girls Trip is a Black movie.
It's a Black movie, for
right.
sure.
And I don't really have a problem with that. But what they do with that data is they use it to justify the making of more of these movies.
Right, right. That's absolutely right.
And the thing that a person like Jason Blum does, who makes a lot of movies that Black people want to go to see
mm-hmm.
is and that feature Black people, is he keeps the budget low. And he doesn't spend a lot of money, so
mm-hmm.
people don't have a problem teaming up with him to get these movies done.
Mm-hmm.
Will Packer follows a pretty similar model. Hmm. These are not expensive movies, and the return on investment is pretty... I mean, the movie's already made its money back, Girls Trip.
Great.
In its
Fabulous.
First weekend. And it'll probably... You know, it'll probably be somewhere near there for another few weeks because the word of mouth is apparently really good. My sister, by the way, called me
mm-hmm.
in a frenzy because she couldn't get tickets in Philadelphia.
Oh.
Sold out. So I think the demand is also high, too.
Absolutely.
The number of theaters will probably expand. But the thing is, we have on our hands this movie. It's going to be a huge hit. And the classic question that always comes up in these scenarios is, where do we go now? Because I don't want to think about this in terms of it's being a black movie. I want to think about this as in terms of it's being a comedy starring black women.
Oh, absolutely.
And the question is, can anybody do it again?
The answer is yes. It'll happen again. Kenya Barris and Ava DuVernay are clearly on some sort of mission to empower as many black actors and filmmakers as they possibly can. The two of them are doing the Lord's work, so shout out to both of y'all. No, they really are, though. I mean, it's like this thing of like bringing in lesser known writers, directors, cinematographers, everything. I mean, they're doing what Beyonce always does, where they're just like, I'm only going to really employ extraordinarily talented black people because nobody else will. It's incredible.
I just want to make it possible to live in a world where we can have your August Wilson and Toni Morrison adaptations.
Absolutely.
But also like have people like Ava DuVernay do whatever it is that she wants to do. And it doesn't have to be a Martin Luther King movie every 15 minutes.
Nope. Slavery or about the Confederacy.
Right.
We can have it all. Right. We want it all.
Yes.
Thanks for everyone who's giving it to us.
That's our show.
That's our show. Still Processing is a product of the New York Times. It is produced by Jenna Weiss-Berman, Henry Malofsky, Ricky Novetsky, and Max Linsky from Pineapple Street Media.
Our editor is Sasha Weiss. We have editorial oversight from Lisa Tobin and Samantha Hennig.
Our theme music is by the incredible artist Kindness. It's called World Restart from the album Otherness.
And you can find all our episodes and fun things at nytimes.com/stillprocessing. And remember, please leave us a review on iTunes. So Jenna, what's going on this weekend?
Oh my gosh, so much. Well, I won't be dropping it low like I did this last weekend, so I can, you know, I'm still going to be in recovery mode. And I know famous last words, but I'm also going to take an herbal workshop on microdosing, experimenting with sacred plants. I can't wait.
What?
Stay tuned. What? Stay tuned for more.